Welcome to Design Your Life, the podcast where we explore the central role design plays in our everyday lives and how, if harnessed correctly, has the power to positively transform the way that we live, design better businesses and sustainable solutions for the planet. We speak to creative entrepreneurs around the world about how they inspire their ideas to life and how they make it all work and the role design plays in their lives. I'm your host, founder of Frost Collective and author of Design Your Life, Vince Frost. Welcome to today's episode of Design Your Life. Today I catch up with a brilliant, multi-talented creative director, author, interior designer, TV presenter, product designer, Sabella Court, founder of The Society Inc. Tune in as we chat about her lifelong love of history, her incredibly curious approach to creativity, and how she navigates working across multiple disciplines with her practice. Hey, Sabella, welcome to Design Your Life. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, Vince.
Oh, it's so cool to have you here in our studio in Alexandria, and your studio is not too far away.
It's 10 minutes.
Is it? St. Peter's?
St. Peter's.
A wonderful studio warehouse.
Yeah, it was the old Taubman's building from 1901 to 1960, roughly.
Wow. And that's a really hot spot for creatives too. There's a lot of cool making going on around there.
It is now. When I was out there, when I moved out there, it was still a little barren with lots of mechanics and sort of heavy-ish industrial. So they cleaned it up. Now it is full of creatives.
Is the axe throwing bar still there?
No, they moved.
Oh. Any incidents?
I'm so bummed. Yeah. I love the throw of the axe and then the laughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Well, oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting distracted already, but I've known you off and on for maybe 10 years, I think. I'm not sure how long.
I thought it might be a little bit longer.
Yeah, maybe it was,
maybe
actually.
Maybe like 14 years.
I think it's when you first came back from New York.
Which was 15 years.
Wow. And you had an incredible life, and you're not finished yet.
No,
you've been prolific. You're doing so much around the world, and now here in Australia for 15 years. I remember I sold you this chest that I had. It was a wooden chest, which is out of a place called Lascaux's in London. And weirdly enough, I bought Adrian Amos's apartment. He owned Lascaux's at the time in Belsize Park, and I lived in that. And living in a house like that, which is like it was a kind of a 1930s apartment, I started to kind of collect pieces that were of that period. And it's interesting how a place can influence. Well, if you're sensitive to the design of a place or its history, etc., not that that chest was a 30s piece, it was way older than that, wasn't it? But it's interesting how places can influence an older place, a heritage place, can influence what you put in it. And I will talk more about that because obviously you're passionate about heritage as well as
yeah, and all of those things are close to my heart about how structure speaks to you and shapes and shifts what goes in there. Absolutely.
Yeah, fabulous. And you're the founder of The Society Inc. Why is it called Society Inc.?
When I first moved to New York, or maybe before I even moved to New York, because I was working there before I moved there, I used to stay at the Gramercy Park Hotel before Julian Schnabel did it up. And you could get long leases on bigger rooms. So we used to stay there for a month at a time or however long I needed. And I'd walk around the perimeter of the park where I think you need a key to get in, a little bit like some of the London parks.
Nice.
And around the perimeter are those amazing brownstones. And it's got a very villagey feel, a little bit like the West Village, but, you know, it's its own little pocket of New York. And I used to walk around as I was getting to know the city, and that first floor, those sort of traditional parlor rooms would be lit up, and each one would be a different society. So whether it was I can't remember what the societies were called, but they were, you know, some were comedian ones, some were explorer societies, all different ones, and they'd have the brass plaque on the wall. And I was like, I want to have my own society, which invites like-minded people to hang out with me and talk about stuff that we all find really exciting. And then goes back to the Royal Society, which was set up, I think, in the 1700s. And it was all male at the time, but they used to do these crazy experiments and all sorts of things. And again, it was that getting like-minded people together to talk about stuff that you'll find really interesting.
It's interesting that society aspect. I remember when I was back in London doing talks at the National Geographic Society, in near the Albert Hall.
Yeah.
And walking into this beautiful building and all the archive and the plaques and everything, and it was so rich. It's so interesting when we're talking about contemporary design at the time. In modern day life, people coming in, you know, in jeans and t-shirts and all that kind of stuff, in a place that used to be full of suits and top hats and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just, you know, one wear of the day that would have been done at the time. But there's lots of those sorts of clubs, like the Explorers Club in New York, even the Yacht Club in New York. Oh my gosh, they're so beautiful. Usually have libraries that you can just hang out in. I mean, obviously you need to be a member.
Yeah.
I tried to become a member of the Explorers Club.
You've got this brilliant design studio, online hardware emporium and purveyor of home goods. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting now I learn more about you, and this is what this podcast is about, hearing about your career and how you got to where you are today, but also how you started out. So it seems to me that you've always been interested in history to start with.
Well, I ended up, I mean, history, yes, I loved it. It was probably the only subject I liked at school. And then when I had the opportunity to go to university, I tried quite a few things, and history was my area that I loved. I never thought that I would use it. I did a BA at Sydney Uni, and I did 4 history subjects a semester. That's about 100,000 words. Jesus. If you put it into essays, I might be exaggerating, but it was an enormous amount of writing, and I just loved the library.
Before AI, too.
Yeah, before AI. And I used to write them by hand, too, because they opened the first Apple shop whilst I was at university, and that would have been the first computer I had. So before that...
Was it with a quill as well, pen and ink?
Of course it was. And I even made the ink. Funnily enough, I have a quill in the car.
Oh, I bet you
with
have.
Ink, funnily enough.
Yeah,
but
autographs.
History, yeah. but I did, I fell for history in a big way, particularly at university. It started at school, but at university it became a whole next level because it suited my learning technique. Like, I cannot rote learn at all. I wasn't great at school, but they encouraged me to study in a way that suited how my mind worked. So I was able to deep dive into research as much as I liked, which is still one of my favorite things. Like the Dewey Decimal System back in the day, like even looking up books and becoming friends with librarians and them holding books for you. And I just spent hours and hours and hours at the library there. And it also gave me the life lessons that helped me in my career of speaking in front of people. Like, I just researched so much, I could come up with my own argument that wasn't, I made up my own questions, and I was able to have these really fantastic debates with my tutors at the time.
Amazing.
And just absolutely adored it. And it gave me that confidence to public speak, which I then have used regularly.
Wow.
But I was quite a shy kid. So this was this amazing opportunity to learn and learn life lessons. It was massive.
And what was life growing up as a younger kid? Like, are your parents into history and all that?
My dad was a residential builder, built the most beautiful houses all around Sydney, eastern suburbs and sort of North Shore.
Mm-hmm.
So I got brought up on building sites, cement, wet cement and sand, still one of my favourite scents, brings back lots of memories.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time on building sites and understanding materials and how space can be shape-shifted into other spaces. He had that amazing mind ability to do it, which I inherited and learnt how to really hone into once I got into more permanent spaces. And then Mum was a teacher, a specialised teacher, and then she really deep-dived into textiles in the middle of the 80s and went on archaeological digs all through Thailand and then ended up specialising on textiles in Uzbekistan and Central Asia was her kind of area of expertise, but she travelled extensively.
So you can see how that both of them influenced you hugely.
Now I'm right there. Yeah.
Wow. Were they surprised by what you're doing?
My mother died 15 years ago, so she hasn't seen what I have become now. But she saw I was well on my way. But I changed a lot when she died. So that last 15 years I've been in Australia has been a big part of a really large chapter of mine that was quite different from my chapter in New York. And my dad died a couple of years ago, but he saw how I made it my own.
Yeah. Well, that's lovely. I'm sorry your parents passed away. After university, what did you do?
Well, whilst I was at university, I was thinking I really need to start thinking about what I want to do, because I'm going to come out of this with a history degree. I did art history as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really set you up for I thought it didn't set you up for a job. But my girlfriend, Edwina McCann, was working at Vogue as an assistant. I mean, now, of course, she runs the gig.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, why don't you come into the office? So I, you know, put some loafers on and a sharp suit. That was the style of 1991.
Wow.
And went in there with Corinne Upton Bacon and various other, who else was there? Tori Collison, and there was a whole group in there that was fun. But fashion wasn't for me. But luckily, Vogue Entertaining and Vogue Living were on the same floor. It was when it was over at Greenwich. So I started loitering with intent on the other side of the office and got in with Sharon Storia and various other people within the other side of the magazine. So the living and food and the travel were more my thing.
I guess you were just inquisitive.
Yes, very curious, always been incredibly curious.
What actually did you do there? Were you doing
I was just helping out. No, I was just a measly little assistant taping shoes on set. But it wasn't for me. So the lifestyle editor...
It lasted a week. No,
it was like a couple of months or something, okay. In and out. But then I started assisting a girl, Kate Gray, who had just left Vogue Living to go freelance. I think she'd been the style editor. So I assisted her for a year for free.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, to learn.
To learn.
Yeah.
To learn. And then...
Hey, guys listening in, there's nothing wrong with working for free if you get something back, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was tough.
Yeah.
It was tough, but... I think I had a boyfriend at the time who helped me out a bit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
I probably did jobs on this. I was working at a bar as well or doing something else. But, you know, long days on shoots. I remember the first shoot I went on, it was with Jeff Lung, who was a big influence in my life, beautiful photographer. And it was for Sheridan. And we worked like 16 hours, you know, these enormous days. I'd say 12 hours, probably felt like 16 hours. But I would just iron sheets for those 12 hours, and I had blisters all over my hands. Of course, I know how to iron a sheet much easier now. I've got more tricks up my sleeve.
You didn't use an ironing board?
Straight ironing my hand.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Well, what about the steamer?
Yeah.
What about the steamer?
Oh, yeah.
You know, but she didn't teach me all these tricks. But I learned them for myself. Now I've made beds for Donna Karan, Calvin Klein, you name it. I became a bit of a bed stylist for a long time. So I've done all the packaging and advertising for all the big guns.
That's incredible.
I am incredible at making a bed.
Wow.
I really am.
There's nothing better.
I'm a pro.
There's nothing better than getting into a bed that's like, oh, crispy and feels wonderful.
I'm very, very good at that.
I mean, that's a big leap from doing all styling all those brands you just mentioned. So how did you get from
there to there?
Yeah.
Okay. So after I had worked for the year for free, I thought I can't just do this anymore. So I started working for a few other stylists. At that time in Sydney, there was only about four stylists. There was Sophie Jacovides, Jane McBean, I can't remember, Kate, you know, so few. So I worked for them and did their shoots, and then soon after, so I'm probably 21 at this time, 22, I started my own company.
Cool.
And just started styling
ironing?
Myself.
Or what was it?
Ironing, yeah.
A bed making company.
No, it was a styling company.
Wow.
So I went freelance myself. Jesus. And I had got on with a lot of the photographers, so it just was on. So started doing advertising, advertorials, lots and lots of editorial. A lot of editorial, worked for all the mags. But then Karen McCartney moved out here and started Marie Claire Lifestyle. So I'm probably 23 at this time. I'm still, you know, I've been working for, I don't know, all the Vogues, everyone. And she came out and put Donna Hay on as food editor, and I was on as lifestyle editor. And we just started doing these amazing shoots that no one had done before. You might remember this. Elle Decoration UK was doing incredible shoots with Martin Morrell and James Merrill. And Ilsa Crawford was at the helm. And then we were doing amazing things here. And Donna and I would do shoots together. First food stylist and interior person to do shoots together, but we would hire people like Hugh Stewart to shoot it. So we'd get fashion guys in to shoot interiors and food, So we changed the format of how that looked.
There's that beautiful blue haze to the work, didn't it?
Yeah, it was gorgeous. And it was a bit more snapshotty than your really strict, static format as well. Although we did that. We did that as well. We worked with Petrina Tinsley and worked with lots of people.
We did Donna Hayes packaging at one stage when she moved to Willara. She had a little shop.
Shop, the old Bay Tree.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were doing that. So that really launched me into another realm. And yeah, that was, and we'd come up with our own ideas and we'd present them to Karen and she'd be like, sure, you've got 10 pages. I need it in 2 weeks. And we'd produce it. Mm. We'd have these tiny little crews. I remember this one shoot we did. Petrina was shooting it. And my parents had bought a Rajasthani tent and it had just arrived. So before they put it in the garden, Donna and I are like, we've got to use the Rajasthani tent.
Sleeps 500.
It's massive. It's not the 500 type. You can though.
Yeah.
But there, it still would seat, 1,500. It's quite a big tent.
Wow.
And we lugged it through the Kurnell sand dunes. And this is before post-production. So we only could use one track in, one track out, because we didn't want the footprints all over the sand.
Wow.
But we had to lug it half an hour from the car park. And I had a 3-seater sofa made out of timber. And we only probably had one assistant between the two of us.
Jeez.
We worked so hard.
Wow.
From sun up to sundown. Still one of my favorite shoots.
But a big idea, a big vision.
Big idea, big visions. Always, always.
And Karen McCartney's awesome. She's actually the first person I had on my podcast.
She's magic.
Super cool.
She's magic, that woman.
So I guess you were doing that at a time that it was like a changing face of publishing and magazines.
And editorial. Yeah, absolutely. And the world was watching.
Yeah. And then you did that for a bit and then you went to New York.
Yes. So Jeff Lung, who I mentioned on my first shoot, he had got asked. Well, the editorial was incredible in Australia and it was being watched. So a lot of the American brands were reaching out to get your portfolio over, and they were bringing a lot of photographers and stylists in. A lot of photographers, but then the stylists went too.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Arnie did. Not sure who else went over. And Jeff got asked to send a few stylist books over and he didn't want to send mine because I was about 23, 24. He thought I was too young. I was like, come on, Jeff, I've got this.
Yeah.
And he sent it. I don't know if you remember, but do you remember the House of Portfolios? And they were black and
handle.
Yeah, the handle, and they'd have the embossing with your name
they
on them.
Beautiful.
I've
padded.
Still got it. Yeah, they're padded.
Yeah.
And you could only buy them in New York and they were really expensive.
Yeah.
That was the only way, and you'd had to ship your portfolio over with, literal tear sheets that you'd put in there because you needed your name on it. It was very, very exacting. And
smell of plastic.
Yeah, the sleeves, and you get new sleeves so they didn't have any scratches on them.
Beautiful.
It was a whole, it was a time. And my book got chosen, and from a few weeks later, I started going to the States. I started commuting to the States. So I'd go over for a couple of weeks on catalogs, and I got on really well with some art directors. So they'd say, meet us in Charleston, meet me here, meet me north of San Francisco. And by the time I got back on the plane, they would have left a message on my phone saying, we need you back in 2 weeks. So I'd sort of slam out my editorial in Australia and be back on that plane.
And what type of brands were you working for?
There was one in particular that I worked a lot with called J. Jill, which is a pretty, pedestrian kind of fashion, accessible, shall we say, accessible fashion.
Commercial.
Yeah, fashion brand. But they were doing really cool things and they loved what we were doing editorially in Australia. So they wanted the messy beds and the food eaten on the table and that really relaxed kind of environment. So I would set the scene for the fashion shoots and then do all the stills. So often there would be a fashion shoot going on and a still shoot going on at the same time. I happened to know all the photographers, which was crazy.
Wow.
Mm.
Was Gary Heary over there doing
no,
stuff?
No, not with me at that time. There was James Merrill from London, Ben Watts was shooting some of the fashion things, Hugh Stewart, and then I started working with much more of the New York-based and UK-based photographers.
And
so Dan Tobin-Smith, Gentle and Hires, Maura McAvoy, Dana Gallagher. I mean, that's endless. I've shot with thousands of photographers.
So where were you based then?
And then I stayed in New York after a job.
Right.
Yeah.
And what was that like?
I never wanted to live there. I was dating a photographer at the time, Hugh Stewart, and he wanted to live in LA. And I was like, if we're going to live in America, we're living in New York. I mean, it was, I was there from 25 to 35, so it was the best time to be there.
Yeah.
And my career was going off. Not everyone knew how to digest what I was doing as well. Like, they loved what you did in America. So you'd walk into a big, you know, advertising meeting. This is where the public speaking went really well. You know, you could hold your own in a meeting. And they'd have all my tear sheets out from Marie-Claire Lifestyle or Vogue or Vogue Entertaining and Travel. And they'd go, this is exactly what they want. But then the translation of that into American terms is quite different to Australian. And there's so many people, there would be so many people on a photo shoot that it would get quite diluted quite quickly, because we worked with skeleton crew on shoots. So you had really big ideas, weren't tainted by too many art directors or a photo editor or all these people that had an opinion, where it got diluted and diluted and diluted. So you had this very raw talent and idea that actually got executed within an Australian team. And then that was quite different when I got to America. But still had a ball. I travelled everywhere.
Yeah. How did you feel that you were compromised by that, when there's so many people having a voice and what was to be done?
I had to work on dealing with it.
Negotiating because
that communication is key, and I was still really young and learning how to communicate. I'm still learning how to communicate with people and, you know, convince them of my idea, thinking it's their idea, all of those sorts of sales kind of strategies that you get much better at as your confidence increases. But yeah, there was some tough times within that. I've learned. It was not tough. It was just learning, especially when you had such a clear vision. I mean, one of my superpowers is seeing the end result before we've done it.
Yep.
Not that there's not flexibility within that, but being able to be a bit more mercurial.
Yep. And did your history background kick in there, or was it later?
No, it hasn't kicked in yet.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
It hasn't kicked in
yet.
What
happened next then?
So, you know, shot for all the greats for 10 years, a decade in New York. And then I wanted to do more, so because I was about 16 years into styling, and if any stylist listening, is pretty hard going. Like, your body is hard. It's your back aches, your neck aches, everything aches. It's a really hard job, prop styling. So I got to meet and borrow the most beautiful props. I mean, my prop tables were better than the shoot. Like, they were so beautiful. And the ceramicists and the makers and the artists and the dyers and all the people that created the things that were on my table, the antique dealers, like, it was just the most beautiful product and things that you've ever seen. And I thought, I'd love to own a shop one day that could showcase all these people, but I want the shop to change all the time. And at this time, so say we're about 2006, somewhere around there, 2007, the retail was really shifting. And as a, you know, I've been a professional shopper really for 30 years, maybe a bit longer. And I was watching the retail change. So we had Ernest Sohn open in the West Village, really the meatpacking side. Donna Karan opened a concept store uptown, about 56th Street and 5th Ave. And even trickled down into more commercial retailers like J. Crew, Anthropologie, and their visual merchandising was just shifting so dramatically. It was about hanging out in a shop and you could read a book, or there was old things, there was new things, there was art. And it was like at the Donna Karan one, which was a much more modern fit out, you could have a juice and you could listen to a record. I mean, this sounds normal now, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But back then, absolutely not. No. This was groundbreaking. Cool. Like, Ernest Sohn had a bar in it, and I was like, I want to do something like this. And it was going to be called the Society Inc. So I found a space in New York. And it was, you know, a huge financial commitment. So it was in Soho. So I came back to Sydney. The jacarandas were out. It was that 2 weeks of spring in August that are gorgeous. I was on the water. I was with my friends. And I threw everything to the wind and moved back home.
So you didn't open in New York?
I didn't.
You were close to it, though?
Oh, I had a contract to sign.
Wow.
And I said, no, something was written in the stars that it wasn't even a decision. I just knew that it was time for me to be back in Australia.
So was that 2006?
was about 2008 by then.
Okay, 2008. Wow. Mm-hmm. And that was in Moore Park near Paddington?
Oh, when I bought my shop? Yeah. I bought that in 2009.
Yeah. So I remember it was a big story. And because you'd left, I'd come to Australia in 2003, so not long before that. And I couldn't work out whether you were American, whether you made your reputation in America and then came here.
No, here.
But you made it first before you went there, which is really cool.
Yeah, yeah. Because I was here until I left here in 1999 or 98. And I started styling in 92, 93, that kind of time.
That's before I was born. Joking. I'm joking, okay.
I was 10.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. That's incredible. So how did it feel? I mean, America and New York and the scale of things and there's a rich history there too. And that coming back to Sydney must have been a bit of a shock as well.
It was a shock, but I had a plan.
Yeah, instantly you opened a shop.
I wanted that idea. I knew it was easily transportable, right, to anywhere. So I knew I wanted to open the shop. On that short trip home, I met Justin Hemmes, and he was working on Ivy, and I had walked through the site. Mm. We just happened to meet at North Bondi Italian, you know, on a long boozy lunch. He was on the next table, came and introduced himself, and we became firm friends. And he was talking to me about what I did over there. So there was sort of some interest in, I suppose, in what I could do for him here that...
So you opened the shop and you started working pretty quickly.
Yes. Well, I decided not to work for a while. When I got back, I just needed to, you know, get a bank manager and buy a car and do those sorts of things because I've been away, recover, buy a house, those sorts of stuff.
Yeah. And why did you open where you opened your shop?
It's
a really beautiful little pocket, wasn't it, away from all the other shops.
It's like. But I like being... away from everyone else. I like being destination. I knew it had more... I didn't want to be a traditional retailer either, so it had that opportunity for me to either live upstairs or use it as an office. And it did both those things at different times. And also that's probably where the history kicks in. Like the idea of an old general store and a corner store that served an area...
Yeah.
Like, that's just magical. And a corner building with the windows. I mean, it was so beautiful.
And people flocked to it.
Yeah, I didn't find it. I don't like looking for real estate. But my girlfriend, Edwina McCann, found it and then took me to the auction and she bidded for it.
Wow.
And we got it.
And it was full of stuff already. So where did that stuff come from?
Well, I bought a 40-foot container home because I'd been collecting things for my shop in New York. I mean, I was that close to signing a deal. So I had an enormous, plus I had three storage spaces of 10 years of prop styling in New York. So I had a masses amount of stuff. I left all my furniture and beds and everything over there, but I bought all shop things out. So actually for the first 3 years, I didn't buy any stock for the shop.
Wow. Talk about the content, because going to your shop or studio recently, a lot of the content is yours, you've created. Was it yours content then, or was it other people's things you collected?
Oh, other people's things, old and new things. It wasn't later until I designed my own range that I was able to have my own products within that. Although I did... I mean, with the store in Paddington, I used to change it every 3 months based on a new paint collection being released that I continue to do with Murabond. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I had the energy to do that, but every 3 months I would pull every single thing out and I would paint the floor and the walls and redo all the visual merchandising and restock the whole shop to match the theme of the collection or the story of the collection.
You seem to be taking it pretty easy since you came back from New York. You've only done 6 books. You've only been a TV series. You've done multiple restaurants designs with Justin Hemmes. I always say Hemmes. Is it Hemmes?
I say Hemmes.
Well, you know him. I don't know him that well.
Yeah, lots of people say it in Hemmes. So many different ways.
God damn it. How embarrassing. Miss G, well, you roll out the whole list of restaurants you've done with him.
With Justin, I did...
I've got a list here if you can't remember them.
Yeah, okay. let me have a look at the list. We did, was that my first one? I mean, we did, I started off small with him. I did like Bistro CBD and I did 30 Knots and then went into Ms. G, Mr. Wong, Palmer & Co, El Loco, Level 6, The Fish Shop, reworked The Ivy amongst working on, I worked in every single restaurant he had at that time. So we worked together for about 7 years.
And we, back in New York, had you done restaurants?
No, so I'd never designed it. Yeah, but I think that's what made those magic. I think we really hit our stride, particularly with Mr. Wong and Palmer & Co. But I, you know, from the age of 20, I would say 18 to 35, I ate out every single day. Probably two meals a day. So I travelled extensively. So the amount of restaurants I'd been to in a period of time was enormous. I think I had done so much research to actually design a restaurant, and I built sets. So I was always noticing all the details. I mean, Keith McNally is my favourite restaurateur in the world. Justin too, but. Keith McNally.
Careful.
I know.
Hey, that's really interesting what you said it's interesting. You know, when I design something or I do TV titles or a book or whatever, I can't help but look at other TV shows and look at the titles. Whereas I've also always intrigued by people who aren't interested in design necessarily.
Mm.
They just watch the TV show.
Oh yeah,
it's like going to a restaurant. You just eat the food and
I know. We do the opposite.
Nice.
I'm like, oh, that light where it's placed on the wall makes that spot really ambient, and everyone wants to sit over there. Or those hooks are interesting placement and make it really easy to hold your handbag. Whatever it is, I'm noting it. Like I can't remember what I did last week, but I could tell you every detail in Balthazar because I ate there all the time, or Pastis, or any of the restaurants I loved. Loved it. Freeman's was another favourite. So I'm constantly storing that kind of information to utilise and make my own when I do my restaurants or hotels.
Did that make it, when you think of a restaurant as a set design or stage set design for entertainment, is that come from your styling background, that it's not, it
comes from
put up for a bit of a moment and then take it away.
Yeah, like, but that comes from, yeah, absolutely. I love illusions. But I also grew up, my mother was a very enthusiastic theatre goer. And so I was going, every Christmas I would get an STC or Belvoir subscription in my Christmas stocking. So I started going to the theatre from a very young age and then, led into sort of more adult theatre. So set design, some of my favourite plays and the set design of them have been a massive influence in where I've got to. So when I started building big sets, that was already in there, the knowledge of it, and how we were such massive moviegoers as well. Like, I don't know if it was like this in the UK, but in the 80s, the Verona and some of the small art house cinemas, I would be going to the movies a couple of times a week.
Wow.
And seeing all the international, all the foreign films, and looking at the set design.
It's how much of what you do is about how you feel. And
all of it.
Okay, great. Okay, can you elaborate? That was a good question. Okay, next question. No, but yeah, so feeling in a place, when you feel a connection with a place, it feels fantastic. Mm. You know, I go to a place, oh my God, I want to eat here every day, or I want to be in this room every day.
So when I work on my design process, that's how I think I want everyone to feel like that, but they don't always know why they're feeling like that. So it might be my very early storytelling that's got such depth that everything marries together in a way that is so comfortable, and you're not sure why you are feeling like that, but there's these layers of storytelling and then the layers of product in there that some of it has its own history already, and I think objects hold a lot of energy, so I always put old in with new. And then on top of that, so then there's all this beautiful old furniture in with new furniture, so the balance is exactly right. The
and
tension.
Real old. Because
yeah.
I hate faux old.
No, not faux old. Yeah. So that tension between old and new is there as well. So you've already got all the energy of objects in there, and then I layer that with all the makers that I use. So it's not just the builders that come in and, you know, make it look like that. I've got scenic painters, blacksmiths, dyers, upholsterers that are traditional upholsterers. My joiners are next level. Like, you think of the plastering is amazing. So the people that come in and then layer it, so all my specialty trades on top of that, they're bringing their stories in. And they're hand-touching it in another way that brings energy into a space. And then you do your lighting. I mean, lighting's absolute key, and your flow within the space. So how I'm always thinking how you're going to make it to the bathroom and what you're going to see on the way and how you are going to experience that. And that is a large part of that is with lighting as well and immateriality.
Yeah, yeah.
But all of that's thought about so that you have that feeling when you get there, and you might see something on the way to the bathroom and go, oh, next time I'm here, already got you. Because next time I come, I want to sit over in that seat. Mm. You know, what's happening over in that corner, which might feel quite different to where you're sitting.
What you brought to interiors has changed, I believe, the local market and how people approach these places. Because before, they were, I felt, cold, modern, austere at times.
Yeah, like you're in the bottom of a pool.
Yeah, clinical. Yeah. And I think that it's interesting when you look, when you think about your past experience where you go in and pop something up, you drag a couch to a beach in a, you know, 5,000-man tent, whatever. But that's kind of a moment in time. How do you feel? And these all these restaurants you've worked on are still fantastic today, and they haven't changed. It's interesting.
Well, they feel like they've been there forever.
Yeah.
That's the
exactly,
trick.
Exactly.
That's
that.
The trick.
But I was then going to ask you was...
the illusion.
It's if, you know, how long's Mr. Wong been around? For 10 years?
No, it's 12 this year.
Exactly. But did 5 years ago, did you want to redesign? No. If it was your restaurant, would you keep?
No, it's so
you'd
good.
You'd fiddle around
there.
A bit, wouldn't you? You
like? No, you would keep your maintenance up. I mean, that's the big thing. I mean, you can go into Hotel Palisade, which I did, and people think it looked like that from the beginning. You know, I mean, I did that about 8 years ago now, I think. But I hope that they have longevity.
And so when did the book start coming out? Because you've done tons.
So when I moved back from New York, it was in December, and I decided to take the summer off. And I spent all this time with my mum. And then she went off to India, and she died very suddenly and unexpectedly. And when she died, there was something that was injected into me of her spirit. I don't know how to explain it, but I changed so dramatically after that. And I had like a jet rocket on my back after that. And my production level just went through the roof. So I went from following a brief, as you would know, for years and years and years. I mean, sometimes I was doing 5 shoots a week. You know, it was a massive amount. You can't even think straight at what you're doing, because you're just following a brief, and you've got, you know, pre-production shooting, post-production, doing it over and over again. And then I had this ability to have a few months off, and then mum dying, I became a big thinker, and it was all sitting there. I just hadn't had time to do it. And with that became massive production. Like, I brought Etc. out. I shot it that 2009. It came out that following year. I released 2 books the following year. You know, and the next year after that, I produced another book. And the year after that, I also designed about 5 places with Justin, plus I was doing about 6 overseas trips, because I was a muse for anthropology in the States, and I would travel extensively with them. And that's how the books came about too. Like, I go back and look at I found a diary recently, and it's got, you know, handwritten, like a Smithson kind of diary. And I was just like, how did I do this? Plus I was running a shop and changing it every 3 months. I just had... I don't know. But I was so excited. I wanted to do everything. And it was all new, and it was such an amazing trip.
So what was that? Was it like an aha moment? You said with the kind of the rocket pack on your back. Did you have a vision that just kind of clicked in?
No, it was more of an emotion.
Because it sounds like you've always been busy.
Yeah, no, I've always been busy. Obviously, I'm high energy and able to produce, and there's an efficiency, obviously, to what I do. I mean, it's not conscious, though.
But that's really cool that you had that massive kick to, and I guess you loved it too. You did more and more and more.
I loved it. And things like working with Justin and change, like you said, we changed the DNA of what the restaurant scene was like. Yeah. And I was, I had the energy and the vision to do things like that.
Mm.
Yeah.
I guess it's that the opportunity to do that and that many. Some people would find that exhausting, but some people like yourself would find it energizing.
Oh, I want to totally do more. Energized. I want to do
a book. And then you also were on a TV show for with the ABC. You hosted Restoration Australia for 2.5 years, which is really cool. What was that like? To go from the shy kid to
If TV someone presenter. Had asked me when I was younger, what's the worst job that you could possibly think of, it would be an actor or an actress. Or an actor, you can just say actor. Yes.
Pays well, though. If you're good at it.
Yeah. Yes, but it wasn't something that I had thought that was in my personality trait. But I loved doing that show. It came off the back of one of my books, Bowerbird, and my publisher put forward my name because she knew I was into history. So this is where the history starts really kicking in. So the heritage and the history. So I did a Zoom call as a, what is it, when you show... you know, talk to people in front of the camera. Casting.
Pitch.
Like a casting. Yeah. So casting via Zoom back in the day was probably something else, not Zoom. It was Skype. Yeah. They were in Adelaide and I got the gig. I think they'd been looking for quite a few months. They'd sort of spoken to a couple of hundred people and I got it and started shooting. I had to fly off to Vietnam the next day to do something with an American company. And then started shooting 2 weeks later. Never done any work in front of the camera.
God.
Ever. Oh, maybe. Had I? No, I had done a TV show. What am I talking about? I'd done a TV show called Homemade.
Okay. Just forgot about that.
Yeah, I was a judge. It was for The Block Guys.
Okay.
On Channel 9.
Okay.
I think I'd done
anything
that.
Anything else
there.
You haven't felt? You failed to
no,
tell
I
us?
Have done another TV show too in America.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Luca's going to kill me.
Well, I can't give you everything. I mean, it's a 30-year career. I can't even remember what I've done.
Okay. Well, that's not helpful. Okay. So you felt okay in front of a camera.
I did. I loved it. I did find out I was pregnant that week as well. So and I didn't tell them. So it was a pretty big week that week.
Wow.
Which I was doing on my own, having a baby on my own.
I'm not going to ask any questions around.
Yeah.
Well, they weren't linked to the show.
No.
It was miraculous. We just don't know how it
happened. No, it was just a miraculous pregnancy.
Wow. How did you make that all work with your business, with all these things you're doing and raising a kid?
Well,
what's your kid's name, by the way?
Silver.
Silver.
She's part precious metal, part pirate.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
How old is she?
She's 10. Wow. My mother named her. She sent me a book in New York 20 years ago, and she was long gone by the time Silver was born. But she sent me a book and said, if you ever have a child, read the beginning of this book. And it was a Jeanette Winterson book called Lighthouse Keeping. And it starts with, my mother called me Silver, part precious metal, part pirate.
Oh.
So she's Silver.
Is she creative?
Yeah, she's creative.
She's got to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I push it on her a little bit.
Oh, really? Mom, I don't want all this old stuff in my room.
Yeah. Surely you love beads and crafting.
Yeah. Wow. Is she passionate about history or where things are from?
Look, she does it when she's talking to me, absolutely not. When I hear her talking to her girlfriends about stuff, absolutely is, you know, and into interior design and all sorts of things. But Restoration Australia really pushed where I started to bring my love of history in. Although all the restaurants too are all full of my storytelling and history.
Yeah. It is. I mean, I guess in a way, you're taking, I guess, contemporary. Well, you're creating an experience. I mean, I think that probably people don't realize how much value you've added to their businesses. I mean, it's beyond being paid to do the job, isn't it?
It's beyond being. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it doesn't stop the day that restaurant opens.
No,
you know,
it's a short window in time. You've probably got like a couple of months to kind of have a concept together for that.
Yeah,
and roll it out, and then you're on to your next job. Whereas that restaurant's humming for 10 years plus.
Yeah, Yeah, I do love the research type. Like some of the complex stories that become our design cues are so amazing. I've actually got better at sort of capturing them so you can read them 10 years later and remember why you did everything, because the research is intense. It's nice when you have librarians on speed dial at the Caroline Simpson Library to help you out.
Fantastic. Yeah. Just thinking about, we do a lot of property marketing and it's not for old homes, it's for new modern homes or apartments and places and destinations and stuff. And I can't help but think over the last, you know, maybe 20 years that we've been doing that the home, because they're modern new builds, they've always been full and styled as if they are, well, as they are, new, now, modern, like the latest Tom Dixon this or Living Edge that or whatever it might be. How do you, and I have this funny story, when I was in New York last time, I think it was like last year, I was walking down the goods line and there was a Zaha Hadid building there and apartments that you could see into the bedroom or front room.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's from the High Line. Yeah,
High Line, incredibly modern building, very shiny.
Yeah.
And I could just see that it was full of antiques. I was just thinking, that is really at odds with the building. And does that matter? Like, and also, you know, I'm from England originally, grew up in Canada, but originally England. And you walk into anybody's house in England, and it's full of old stuff. You know, we've always lived that way, kind of collected old things. Whereas this modern way of living today is people often just say, right, I'm moving to a new place, just going to throw away everything I had. I'm going to go to IKEA and get everything, or I'm going to go get everything new, or shit, what do I put in here?
You know. Yeah. But that goes back to, I think it's about getting at the tension of the old and new in there. I mean, I did a Durback Block Jagger house that was built from scratch that we did in Lavender Bay, and we did all the interiors on that and the lighting and everything. So I worked very closely with Neil on it, and what we ended up with was something so amazing. He's one of my favorite architects that I've ever worked with. We had the best time, but I put lots of old modern pieces in there that we restored, and like the ribbon chair, and you still, I think it's so important to have the older things, old things in there, and also handcrafted things. So it's back to what we were talking, you know, about before, of why you get a certain feel when you walk into a restaurant, but you're not sure why. I do that in homes as well, because I actually build a lot of homes from scratch. I just don't talk about it.
And how if you're doing it for someone doing their interior, how much of their life comes through to that versus you saying this is what you need to do and fill your house with all my stuff?
Well, I never do that.
Oh, you don't?
No, ever. Okay. I'm the most unbossy interior designer you could possibly come to, because at the end of the day, I'm not living there. So following a brief comes back from the styling days where you followed a brief. So you knew how to follow a brief so well because you had to shoot it the next day. There was no time for running out and getting something else. So that's a real skill in itself. So really understanding client and getting to where they need to be, because you do walk away from those ones and they make it their own. So I never like to push anything on them. I like to, you know, educate or reveal of how they might like certain pieces because I know what clothes they wear.
Yeah.
You know, so there's all of these design cues that are from an individual that can then be translated into object.
That's really interesting.
Or color.
That's really interesting. When I think, I've lived in 53 homes.
Yeah, wow. That's
insane.
A lot of homes.
It's insane. Yeah. And I'm thinking, I've kind of done that since like 18 was the first time I moved out of home. If I kept everything that I had from that moment, that'd be bizarre. Would I be living in the past? Like, have you got everything in your house? Is everything you've ever owned?
Do you ever get rid of stuff? It is a curation of, absolutely, it's a curate. It is a 3D timeline of my life.
Mm.
Absolutely. The beauty of having a shop is you can have a go and then you can sell it to a new custodian of an object or a piece of furniture, which is lovely. But I do have I am partial to keeping certain things like labeled drawers. like the ones I bought from you.
Yeah, I don't want to buy those back.
Well,
I now feel sad about that.
But, you know, I'm entering into a new chapter of my life. Yeah. And I am
You're not going all modern, are you?
No, but I'm imagining that I'm going to live in a, you know, in a mid-century house or a modern house. It's not to say all my stuff's going to be new, because that will never happen to someone like me or me in particular. But I am doing three auctions, and I will be reducing my collection by 70%.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm not going to be doing that this year.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I'm just ready.
Is that a reset?
Yeah, there's something that shifted in me that I am about to enter a very new chapter that I'm very excited about. It'll be my first new chapter after I have moved back from New York.
How do you feel about how far you've come? I mean, do you feel like you've still got tons more to do?
I do.
Because anyone listening in or looking at your work and all the things that you've done, you go, holy crap, how the hell does she do all that stuff?
I know, people ask me that all the time.
And
I don't
still
feel
only
like
25 or something.
Look, I don't think I'll ever stop, but there will be a shift in, you know, how much I produce, I assume. But also, once you love doing the things you do, there's a product that comes out of it.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a podcast or a book or a product or all sorts of things. Like, the amount of products I design for other people is quite prolific as well, not just what we produce for ourselves. I'm not saying I need to flood the market with more things designed by me, but there can be, I don't know, the outcome of an idea can come in so many platforms and formats.
Well, just talk about, we're going to wrap it up in a second, but yeah. I just wanted to talk more about that feeling, that joy, or I don't want to give you the words to use, but that feeling of taking something from here to here, or having an idea and bring it to life, or having a brief and making it happen. Not just making it happen in a kind of, let's get it done, but in a way that's passionate, determined, and it's, you know, new ideas, new thinking around that. Well, like, where does that come from?
I don't know exactly where it comes from, but I do understand. Well, maybe we can brainstorm it together without, like, just shutting it down. Yeah, okay. We'll get some figures around. But I think it's also having that ability to, and this is that sort of superpower thing of having the ability to visualize something, how it's going to look at the end. It doesn't always turn out exactly how you did it. And there's flexibility with the journey to get there.
Yeah.
But I do imagine it at the end. Like, even my restaurants that I do, I know, I see the people in there drinking at the bar with the glass that I've chosen at the height bar it is. Like, it is a finished product. And I think coming from a publishing background too, where you have an idea and there's the journey to get there and then it's published in a magazine, that's the published bit is really important to me too. Whether that's when the bar opens or the podcast get released or the book comes out or whatever format or that is in, I've already seen it in my mind's eye, and that makes that design process so interesting, because I already know what the restrictions, the storyline about it, what materials are going to be in there, what all the parameters are around that to make it have the essence that I know how it's going to feel.
Do you see, I'm similar in a way when I'm working on brands or projects that kind of visualize what it's going to be like in the real world, which is really cool, but do you foresee, you know, when you talk about being published, that's then curated, that's further editing's happened after what you've done. Mm. Like, okay, we've done a shoot for a weekend and we've got 50 shots and it's Cameron Carton is telling you've got 10 pages.
Yeah.
You're going, holy crap, I wanted, you know, my vision was
bigger. Yeah, a book. Yeah, I had a book in
and a
mind.
Movie. Yeah.
Well, look, I've been lucky enough to work with really incredible art directors. You know, sometimes there is disappointment, but often you get to a stage too, and luckily enough, at a very early stage, I was able to see things before they got published as well. So have comment
influence
within that. Yeah, decisions. Influence.
So and, it wasn't 10 pages. It ended up being 20.
Yeah, it might have been 14 pages.
Poor Karen McCartney.
That creative direction has been a big part of my career journey, absolutely, and has become a bigger and bigger role that I have now.
Have you designed your life so far?
Oh, I think I always called it writing my own job description. Absolutely, I've designed my life. Mm. No one else has had one quite like this.
And how do you stay well?
Pilates.
Pilates.
Walking in nature, hiking, paddleboarding, snorkeling, all of those, eating well.
And is all that just before breakfast or like, or is that over a period?
Well, I went for a mountain bike ride this morning so I could watch the setting moon. I watched the moon rise out of the water down in the national park last night, and then I watched it set this morning.
Actually, quickly talk about where you live. You live in an insane place.
I do.
Like it's remote, but not far from everything, but yeah. It's a choice you must have made.
Yeah, it's a town of 2,000 people, I think. And it is remote. It's Bundina. It's in the Royal National Park. It takes me an hour to get to work, but 25 minutes each way of that is driving through the national park, and it's beautiful. It's the second oldest park in the world, and it is my backyard.
And why did you decide to live there? Was it a house that you fell in love with?
Well, it ended up being a house, but I actually fell in love with the area. I didn't know that area at all. As a kid, we used to go up north, never south. Not to say it's that far south, but it was definitely not a stomping ground in any shape or form. And a girlfriend of mine was actually building a container ship house down there. And being someone who loves the building process, I used to go down every couple of weekends to see where they were at. I hadn't seen a container house being built before, so it was super interesting. And I loved the drive. And then I kept looking, thinking, I could do this. And it's not bad from St. Peter's. And then a house came up that was timber and ripe for a reno. And I wanted to sink my hands into my own reno, which I've just completed after about 4 years. That was it. That was the eastern suburbs to Bundina. New York, Paddington, eastern suburbs, Bundina.
Is next going to be a houseboat or something? Like
maybe. No, a houseboat or a pier. I want to live in a P&O house.
Yeah.
Or a P&O house, I think, would be my style next.
I saw a beautiful house that just sold in Paradise Beach. They came on the market.
Where's Paradise Beach?
It's just near Avalon on Pittwater.
Oh, I want to move to the northern beaches.
It just came up and went on the weekend. It was just incredible. It looked like a P&O type style. Just thinking in terms of doing what you're doing, where you're creating environments for other people and for yourself, how could you ever be settled in a place? Because once it's done, surely you think, oh, I've seen another house I want to do. Or, you know, has that happened to you?
There's a time of a need to move because my favorite and most inspiring time is in movement. Mm. Like that's why I love travel so much. I love being in movement. But it doesn't mean I want to move all the time because I have a lot of stuff, so it takes a little bit of time. But once I do imagine myself in a new place, that is the beginning of it. And I don't look at the real estate pages at all. It's not my... I'll do auction, scroll
so
through the auctions, but I don't scroll through the real estate thing. So I think that's a plus for me because I probably would want to move. Because I do get attached to architectural designs and houses and all sorts of things. But no, I don't move that often. Not 53 times in a much smaller amount of years.
It might be slightly exaggerating, but it's around that number.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to find it incredibly unsettling moving, although exciting. I love the best thing is waking up in the first morning after you've got semi-unpacked and you wake up, there's no curtains or whatever, and the sun's coming in, and it's that new environment is fantastic. I love it.
But it makes you think differently too. I remember when I was moving from Paddington, which was a small, intimate space, and then I imagined myself being in a warehouse space, and how I imagined being in there helped me find where I moved to, because once I imagined more space, everything started to shift and change.
Yep.
And now I am imagining myself in a P&O house or somewhere else, and there's a move coming.
Yeah.
Absolutely, there's a move coming. I can feel it.
That's really cool. And it's harder to do when you got kids, isn't it? I know that when
my
kids were younger, it's really hard to move once they get settled into a place.
It is.
It sounds really cool that you're living kind of, an uncompromised life, that you are designing your life, you're doing what you believe in, you're passionate about what you're doing, you're not necessarily doing it for the money. You're doing it because you're in demand. And it's cool to be needed. It's cool to have people say, hey, I want you to do my place or my restaurant or whatever.
Or they ring, actually, and they don't know what I do, but they want me to do something.
Now they say, listen to the podcast with Vince.
But the nice thing is that I'm not pigeonholed. Yeah, like the interior design is part of my, it's under the umbrella of, but there's so many other things within that I get asked to do. Yeah. And that's what I find super exciting.
You're a businesswoman, you're a product designer, so much more, publisher.
Yeah, author. I think that business, big thinking business part of it will be more of the next chapter.
Yeah, it's exciting. So, Bella, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
That was fun.
Cool. Thanks for listening in today's episode of Design Your Life with the brilliant, multi-talented Sabella Court. Tune to the next episode where I catch up with Aidan Anderson, founder of The Local Project, Australia's fastest growing design publishing house. Thanks for listening to this episode of Design Your Life. If you'd like to find out more about how you can design your life, head to the website at designyourlife.com.au. If you found this episode inspiring, please don't forget to review and subscribe. If you have any ideas or like to get in touch, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email at hello@frostcollective.com.au.